Yes, to me, it's been a very urgent topic. I stumbled into Le Brie in Switzerland before I was a Christian. I was just searching and confused and so on. And in the mid-60s, where the discussions were all about epistemology, all about how can you know this and how can God reveal himself in words, where words are so able to be misused and so on, and how can you have enough evidence to believe in the God who you claim to be there. I became a Christian in the course of a year, not at Le Brie, but going back and forth to Le Brie in the course of a year, and then eventually ended up in seminary and so forth, came back in 1970, married with a wife, and at the Swiss Le Brie again, because Schaefer, after people go to seminary, always wanted to check, are they still okay after the seminary experience, which is a very wise thing to do. So we spent several months at the Swiss Le Brie at that point before going to England. But immediately it struck me, going back in 1970, questions are all different. It's who am I? It's already the therapeutic revolution has hit the Le Brie students, and they're not asking them questions, how can I believe, how can I have evidence for God when God is infinite and all our evidence is finite, all these sorts of things. But it was, who am I anyway? Because I'm very confused about who I am, and I don't believe any of the people that want to tell me who I am. From that point, I started to really think, this must be a question that the Bible addresses. And as the more I studied, the more I realized, yes, it really is a question that the Bible it does address. And I was pretty unhappy with the other Christian ways of coping with it, with that question. So I think, as Jock said, because I wrote this book, Beyond Identity, it takes me at least 10 years to write a book. Is still around to start the thing off here. Quite a lot has happened since that book came out, but interestingly enough, the subject of identity has not gone away in the meantime or become obsolete. The subject of identity has exploded, really, has expanded, and is all over the place, and that's part of the confusion that we, I think, experience today, is that it's identity everything. At the same time, and I'm not going to spend so much time on what's going on at the moment, but at the same time, there's an awful lot that has not changed. People are kind of the same, though they talk differently and they raise different issues. People have not changed. God has not changed. So I'll be jumping back and forth a bit between biblical studies and what I think is going on in the world today. In this talk this morning, I'm going to start out with, well, what is identity, or at least how am I going to be talking about it? Let's understand what the terms mean. And be doing that with a biblical understanding. And then turning toward the end of this talk on the idea that in modern thought, identity has been shrunken. It's miniaturized itself, and this is part of our struggle today. The second talk I'll be dealing more really with, okay, how do we actually have an identity that's grounded in Christ? So I'll begin with if everything works here, it's always nice to know the speaker has a plan, and it's a plan, but not going to be a lot of dramatic PowerPoints, but starting with a roadmap of identity. Start with images of ourselves. As you go through your daily life, you sometimes reflect on yourself. We as human beings have an amazing ability with our consciousness can reach out and turn back on itself. In other words, you as an observing subject, conscious subject, you could turn your consciousness around and look at yourself. To our understanding, no other creatures can do that who are walking around or existing on Earth at this time. you become the object of your own observation. Every time you look in a mirror or even walk past a shop window that gives you a reflection of yourself as you walk along the street, it's suggested to you by these things that you think about yourself, you have thoughts about yourself. You turn up, in this process, you turn up images of yourself, pictures of yourself, stories of yourself from within your mind. You don't need help to do it, you can do that from within your mind, that also evaluate you in ways of a huge range, from self-confidence to self-disgust. And then you have input from other people, other sources, who tell you things about yourself that you remember sometimes, for good or ill. You have to make sense of that, sometimes very supportive, sometimes praising, sometimes in gratitude, sometimes cussing you out or rejecting you. Again, images of you that are strong or weak, success or failure, that you have to cope with from other people. And it makes a huge difference, as you all know very well, who those people are in terms of how seriously you take what they've told you about yourself. It makes a huge impact on you if certain people that are close to you, that you respect, particularly within family, give you an impression of yourself that you somehow have to take pretty seriously. And that can be a scar and something very, very difficult to deal with, or it can be something that's very, very encouraging. So that's images of self coming from in your own head and coming from the world out there. There's a second sense of self-image, though, which is how it's almost used perhaps even more today, more talked about today. That's the image of yourself that you have that you try to project to other people. That your image you have of yourself that you make public, that you try to control or at least influence what other people think of you and feel about you. That's going to be important to you. We're told this daily. That's going to be important to you socially and economically. How do you project your image? What image do you have to send out to the world? Decades ago, a man called Irving Goffman, some of you have heard of him, wrote a book called Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. This is sort of a Bible for people dealing with these sorts of issues. He wrote it, I don't know, it must have been the 50s or the 60s, but it's very interesting, but quite cynical, because he had a term that's always echoed in my mind called covering this whole process of what picture of yourself did you want to project. It's called impression management. Impression management. We all do, to some degree, impression management. We manage the impressions we're trying to send out. And he, fairly cynically, I judge this having written a whole book on cynicism to try and help myself be less cynical, and maybe others too. I think this is, he has a cynical conclusion, is that impression management is the main thing you're doing in all your social interactions. The main thing that governs our social interaction is you managing the impression that you're trying to give to the people you're with. Now, I think that's cynical, I think that's too all-encompassing a judgment. So I think impression management is there. It varies radically in how much we do it consciously or unconsciously, but it's not the whole story. We've got more to do with our lives than manage our impressions. And a question is created for us between these two kinds of self-image. The self-image that we have of ourselves in our own heads, that it's a private affair, and the self-image we have that we project out to others. And that problem is, how close is my self-image which I project to what I know is actually true about me? In other words, how much is it a mask or a lie? Or where is the role of authenticity or honesty in my interaction with other people, given what I know about myself and given what I project? Am I a phony? Is it all a mask? What's the deal? And that gets immediately into identity issues of who am I? Am I a person who is basically honest in my as I relate to others with what I know and what I said, or am I totally dishonest? Or because I project a very different thing to other people, do I not have a clue who I really am? That's where a lot of people are today more. A big difference that makes people really wonder who they are themselves. So this brings us to the question of identity. The word identity comes from a root meaning sameness. It's the same word from the same root, as you can imagine, as the word identical. So it has very much to do with sameness. When I use it, I'm going to mean two things, which I don't think this is a radically strange view of identity. I read a lot about identity over the years. Studied actually in college under the guy who invented the term identity crisis, Eric Erickson. But I mean two things from it, which are both connected, but able to be distinguished. First, identity has to do with a self-sameness, an inner coherence or cohesion. In the midst of all the diversity of images that are flashing about, there's some sort of coherence that I have about myself as to who I am, rather than being completely confused about who I am or whatever. So the first thing that it means is a solidity and confidence in the way you experience yourself. Not that it never budges, not that it changes, not that it's fixed, but a basic confidence in the self that you are. The second is your ability to accept and respect that, I would claim, imperfect self. That you can live with that self, that you can have a certain self-respect. I like self-respect better than self-esteem, because self-esteem means we need to put, implies to me putting myself up on some sort of pedestal or self-praise. I'm not interested in self-praise here. I'm interested in self-respect, self-acceptance. So a sense of coherence and a sense of self-acceptance. So the question is, how can we be one self despite all the different images of ourselves and the different images we might project on other people? Being one self despite all the changes also across time and place. Who we are has to do how we see ourselves may have to do with where we are, who we're with, as well as certainly time. When I say I wasn't myself yesterday, what do I mean? Who is that self that I wasn't? Well, it implies a certain picture of yourself that you weren't yesterday, so it's not nothing. We're not talking about finding your identity as if in the same way that you could find a lost sock or the car keys. Nor have you found it even when you wrote, let's say, a good autobiography. Something much more inner, something much more internal, something having to do with your piece as an internal self that stretches into the past and stretches possibly into the future. Ironically, we're most conscious of the issue of identity when we're aware of being without it, aware of our lack of it, aware of the painful gaping hole about the absence of identity, a lack of cohesion, a lack of self-respect. You recognize it in what the psychologists call people who are identity hungry. They have to brag all the time and tell you how wonderful they are. They relate everything that events that take place only to their own, how this affects them. They will try and impress everyone to try and bolster some sense of self. So we're most aware of it when it's lacking. On the other hand, if you have a strong sense of identity, you may be able to live much of your life without worrying about yourself, just getting on with doing stuff that you're meant to be doing and that you want to be doing. So you're not always processing everything through how does this work with my impression management? How does this work with my self-esteem? How does this work? And are not dominated by these things. But we just get on with, I think Tim Keller's written a little book called the Blessed Self-Forgetfulness. That's a wonderful term. If it's not just forgetfulness by blanking out yourself, it's it's being involved in all sorts of things that God's given you to live as a way out. If we look at this in biblical categories, you can look at a weak identity. I often thought of Jesus warning to Peter on his last Thursday night, Satan desires to sift you like wheat. What does that mean? What is the shape of sifted wheat? What shape is it? It's got no shape. It's got shape of whatever container it's in. If it's on the floor, it's all over the floor. If it's in a jar, it's in a jar. If it's in a bag, it's in a bag. But the shape of wheat is anything that it is put into. Any shape has no shape at all. This is what Jesus told Peter. Satan desires to sift you like wheat. And in fact, that night, fear was able to bend Peter into a shape where he did something that absolutely horrified him. Very soon afterwards, he denied Jesus three times. So he denied Jesus, who he'd been 3 years with, loving and promising the world all, even if all these other bums deny you, I would never deny you. And yet he denied Jesus three times that evening. And I just imagine him saying something that I think maybe some of us can relate to and remember of how could I have possibly done what I just did? Given who I know about myself, who don't do that, what I just did, I just did it. That's the kind of experience of being sifted like wheat, having an identity that's been shattered, that's been thrown around. Who am I? Am I a coward? Am I a total hypocrite? Am I just a mask? This is for him was a crisis of identity for Peter, and in the midst of an avalanche of both guilt and shame. And those are two things we're going to pick up all the way through. Go along, guilt and shame. These are negations of our self-respect. These are things that stand against our respect for ourselves and really have to be coped with. What is a person like with a strong identity? It's like in the first Psalm, a tree planted by the river, bearing fruit, not withering despite changes in weather and water and so on, and being strong. Or take Peter a few weeks later. Take Peter a few weeks later as he stood before the same authorities he'd been terrified of and said, you wonder who has healed this person who's right standing before you in the temple? I tell you who's healed this man. Jesus Christ, this is meaning the Messiah of Nazareth. It's in his power that he's been healed, who you murdered, you just crucified, and God raised from the dead. That's the answer to your question. You know, standing up before all the leaders in the temple and say, and they of course say, who is this guy? He hasn't even been to a seminary. He's, how can he talk this way? And the other guys, where are they coming from? And so that this is suddenly a strong identity who says he isn't worried about himself. He's not worried about his, right away, you know, he's not worried about dying right away there. He says, well, that's, you'll do with me what you want. He was thrown in the jug immediately, and he got out in wonderful ways. But you can see the difference there of someone functioning from strength. He wasn't worried about himself. He was just doing what he knew was the right thing to do. But on account of this kind of strength, we need to take another step forward, this kind of strength as an expression of identity, just as clashing images of ourselves call for identity to find some coherence and self-respect in them. So the search for identity pushes us beyond identity to something that is a foundation for it, a grounding for it, is something solid beneath identity. So is there a foundation for identity? That's a huge question. Is there a foundation of purpose for our purpose for our lives? Or are we just strange, out-of-place accidents in this accidental little blue planet somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy, having no more significance or purpose than a stick or a stone? Those are totally real questions that are out there today, and many very learned people believe we don't have any value or purpose more than a stick or a stone. They don't live by that judgment, but they publish that judgment and get Nobel prizes often for making judgments like that. So do I matter in any way? Do I have any purpose beyond keeping my pulse going? Is there such thing as a life well lived? If there is a moral order, if there is such a thing as a life well lived, where might it come from? Where might we find out about it? From biochemistry? From the late hunter-gatherer society? From my parents? From some sort of majority vote? From the shopping mall? Or maybe even from God? The plausible Christian claim is that God alone is the foundation for our identity. The only explanation for why we are the way we are and have these very burning and unsettling questions, like the question of who am I, that we need to worry about. Unless we're the unique images of God, why do we raise and feel such strange questions of meaning or ultimate value? Dogs and squirrels don't have questions about meaning or identity. Christian claim is that only in relationship to God, our Creator, who identified himself when he was asked, who in the world are you, as I am that I am. That's who Moses was meant to tell the people who he was, I am that I am, which if you stop and think about it, is the claim of completely self-sufficient identity. I created, therefore I am. I am that I am. Only he can make sense of the full range of human needs and questions from each one of us. And each one of us, made in his image, is an I am. You all have an I am within you. You're a center of consciousness from which you make decisions, make commitments, back up from them, whatever. Our own I am-ness is not self-sufficient. We can't say, I am that I am. We say, I am all sorts of things, whether it's Descartes' I think, therefore I am, or people more out of the Romantic movement later on, I feel, therefore I am, or I'm the boss, therefore I am. They don't usually say those words. Or what one of my friends said, I am what my father is not. That's another angle. But he at least needed to identify his I am-ness with some negation, at least, as opposed to something positive. But we somehow need to attach our I am-ness to something, to build it onto something, and that's what I'm trying to say is really the Lord. In terms of being a finite image of God's identity, that is what leads my own identity to take shape. Now I'm going to just look at two areas out of four. I'm going to deal with two of them now and four in the next lecture, which is coming up at the end, I guess. Four things that are building blocks that I find in the biblical idea of humanity to be significant in what builds our identity or, without it, tears it down. The four areas are moral values, heroism, dominion or agency, and love. I'm going to talk about moral values and heroism this morning. First, moral values. We have in the Old and New Testaments a picture of how we should live as images of God, which is to image God. So image is a noun and image is a verb. Because you are an image of God, you are expected to image God. As you do image God, you become more yourself. Your self is grows and is becomes what it's meant to be in the course of your life. So our ultimate authority for this is God's character, which comes to us in his word. And so it's his image which is called, we're called to form ourselves or shape ourselves around or mold ourselves around. That seems very crude. You think of building yourself around a mold, but think of wood, building a wood boat where you have to have some jig or something around which to bend pieces of wood to make a boat at the end. All those are very crude compared to what it is to be shaped as an image of God. But it's the same idea of a coherent idea into which we are shaped. God's wisdom and commandments tell us about this, and ultimately the ways of Jesus tell us about this and show us about this. And that this will, because we are made in the image of God, because this is to image God, we will flourish as we do it. it will be good for us to do. It's good. We are the beneficiaries. Sin, on the other hand, is rebelling against those commandments and the teaching of wisdom, warping God's image, and so tearing down our identity. Sin batters our identity, scars our history with blood and barbed wire, and our lives with guilt and shame. Human guilt is real, and we're held accountable for it, but we don't like to feel guilt very much. We don't like it being referred to very much. We tend to resist the honesty that would push guilt into our consciousness. We see this immediately in Genesis 3, where there's this shifting of blame, there's excuse, there's denial, there's rationalization. We deceive ourselves over what we've done and not done. We talk at LaBrie and at LaBrie conferences a lot about every human being is a glorious ruin. That should not just be a LaBrie cliche. That should be seen as something that is a very, very profound description of the two sides of human being, of human existence. We are a glorious ruin. You are each glorious ruins. The person sitting next to you is also a glorious ruin. We are all glorious ruins because we're glorious because we're made in God's image, the image of a glorious creator God. But we're ruins in that we've fallen into sin and we've betrayed God and tried to set ourselves above God's authority. And all this has backfired in our faces, both individually and in trying to live well with each other. So this is moral reality. I want to talk then about heroism, which I'm trying to deal with and get us to raise sort of consciousness about the reality of it. I think heroism is dismissed as something that kids deal with, and maybe they write about it in Hollywood a bit, but I think there's something very deep here that is much more present in our lives than we normally think, and is very powerful and important. I'll be coming back to this a number of times. But a hero, heroes are people who show us what to us is honor, glory, and true greatness. Enough for me to aspire to being like them, to want to become like them in some way, in a way that I look to as heroic. Heroes connect they're in your imaginations. We're talking about the activating our imagination. Heroes connect your imagination to your own future. You have no heroes, your imagination is disconnected from your future in a very important way. Heroes give specific human shape to the idea of aspiration. They're powerful in shaping you toward who you want to become. Huge part of identity, not surprisingly, is who are you trying to become? Who would you like to become? Who would you want to imitate and why? This imaginative capacity comes from being in God's likeness. It gets right back to being in the image of God. We are created to hunger for glory because we're images of the God of glory. So it goes all the way back to the theology of God. God is, you look at many books of theology and you look at the attributes of God, glory is usually the last attribute that is mentioned, not always, but in many theologies of God. And that's because glory is the sort of sum, it isn't sort of a narrowly single thing, but it's sort of the sum total of God's excellence, of God's wonder and radiance and his excellence. So we're created to hunger for glory because we're images of the glory of the God of glory. But as sinners, we often let other stories and images become heroic to us, other stories than those that are influenced by the Christian faith, other stories from pop culture from just our own vanities. Warp our definition of glory. See, we have a capacity to understand and seek for glory, but the question is, what is the content of that glory? Where does it come from? Where do we get our idea of glory from? And that's why one of the reasons why it's very important to think about heroism. You see children start very young wearing a hat of a nurse or a hat of a fireman. Or a policeman or something like that they respect, and that they're dealing already with something that they could see as greatness in the adult world. But it's not just a kid's thing. The reality of heroism goes all the way through. There's a fascinating book by a professor from Harvard Business School. It's called Heroes Farewell. And it is a study of the retirement pattern of CEOs as they retire from their businesses. And in their need, many of them, not all of them, many of them, to retire in a way in which they're heroic. One of the examples, which I can't remember from that, it's from this book or from someone I talked to about this book, gave the example of a CEO of a major airline who held his job as CEO until he was 94, at which point he appointed his successor, a man who had terminal cancer. And he, as planned, died within 6 months, and then this guy came back as heroic to save the day. Okay? That airline, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it is no longer in business. And I'm not saying that's his fault, but it's a pattern. I want you to see, this is the idea of the reality of heroism is operative all around us, and we miss it to our loss. You think that old folks like that, at least they don't need to worry about this. Well, they do. Failure in morality and heroism. Failure in both morality and heroism both attack our sense of identity. They're dealing with, particularly the area of self-respect or self-acceptance, because they are negative information about ourselves as we accumulate failures. We're dealing with here with guilt and shame, which bring us enormous negative feedback, which we have to process somehow. What do you do with it? You fail. We all fail. How do you process that failure? This is where I'm just so unbelievably grateful for the gospel. And I'll get at this more tomorrow or whenever the next lecture is the wonderful way that we deal with failure in the sight of God. I won't get you there yet today. Guilt and shame give you enormous negative feedback. In the Bible, guilt and shame point to two ways of evaluating ourselves, the two ways I've just described, morality and heroism. We can better understand as we think of their opposite. Guilt has to do with moral failure. The opposite of guilt is innocence. Shame has to do with failed heroism. And its opposite is not innocence, but is honor and glory. That's through the Bible. Think of biblical statements like, he glories in his shame. That's a person whose values are completely upside down. He glories in his shame. What he ought to be ashamed of, he glories in. Or God, in judgment, turns their glory into shame, turns their glory into its opposite. Guilt is felt as a transgression of a moral law. Shame is experienced as a violation of whatever to you it is to be heroic. Shame is the experience of being a negative hero, not zero, being a less than zero hero. Not just neutral and absent heroic behavior, but a hero on the negative scale. It helps to understand there are three different ways that guilt and shame can interact with each other, because I think it's hard for us to get a grip on how they affect us. And this is all totally identity geared to how we experience our identities. Three ways they relate to each other. We can experience guilt and shame at the same time for the same reason. In other words, you can have total overlap between guilt and shame. Think of the example. You can tell, under pressure, you can tell a good friend a lie, a bold lie. You think you experience guilt for that. You know lying is wrong. You know you've transgressed a law of God. You've broken it. You always condemn other people when they tell lies, especially when they tell them to you. But it's guilt for having broken, having transgressed. But we can at the same time feel shame, which I want you to distinguish it here. Negative heroism, because we're disgusted with ourselves for being such a coward that we couldn't tell the truth, we didn't dare tell the truth. See, that's a little bit different. At a psychological level, it's a different activity. It's being deeply disappointed with the self that you thought you were, but you weren't. You turned out not to be. So you've had a picture of yourself stuffed in your face that's different from how you usually think of yourself. The fall from self, from who you thought you were. In this case, guilt and shame reinforce each other. What I'll be trying to argue today is if our standards are the same, of morality and heroism, if they're in focus, we will feel guilt and shame at the same time. And they'll both join to push us to clean up our act, let's say. Okay, guilt and shame can go together at the same time for the same reason. Secondly, guilt and shame can also function independently of each other. We experience shame without guilt for all sorts of violations of our own view of heroism. Things that are not moral issues at all. For example, all of us would know what it is to be ashamed of your bodies. We're ashamed of our bodies sometimes. Some people much more than others. But we're the wrong shape. We're the wrong size. We're too fat. We're too thin. We're too tall. We're too short. We trip and fall flat on our face in the middle of some public event. If we play football, we drop a pass in the end zone. Baseball, we strike out when the bases are loaded and there's only two out, or there's two out. We're wearing the wrong clothes at the right party. We can feel serious shame, serious unheroism, which is feeling shame, which is a powerful and intense negative piece of information that you have to do something with. And we can feel an enormous amount of shame for things like this. We must understand that this shame can be self-rejection for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with morality. The things I've listed here have nothing to do with a moral problem, but you can feel totally unacceptable yourself for them. Nothing to do with sin or moral failure. The shape of your nose is what God gave you, and it's not a moral problem, even if you don't like it. So if our glory, if our glory and so our heroes come from, say, Hollywood and Madison Avenue, they will likely be what the Bible would call pseudo-heroes, or I would call, given biblical truth, a pseudo-hero, who don't represent true greatness at all, but represent your notion of greatness that you've picked up, that you've adopted, that you've internalized, and learned to live with. But they can exert a tyrannical power over you to make you ashamed of just being the person God made you to be, to feel unacceptable, defective, and even in a strong form, it's a mistake that you even exist. I've talked to people with middle shame who the essence of that feeling is, I am a mistake, I should not have existed. Think of any experience of shame, tie a string onto it, and you'll be able to follow that string back to some hero or sense of the heroic that it has violated, which is an interesting exercise to find out what's going on. You follow the string back to some hero or heroic which you have failed. The shame reduces you to the thing that you're ashamed of. That's all there is to you. That's what shame does. It reduces you to what you've just done. That's all there is to you. That's who you are. It defines you. So when shame is independent of moral reality, it can be a huge distraction from all that God does want you to care about. Okay. Guilt and shame can be at the same time for the same reason. Guilt and shame can be quite independent. I'm skipping over a lot of things here, but I'm getting the most important things. Thirdly, guilt and shame can work absolutely against each other, oppose each other. The highest moral reality for the Christian is knowing and following Jesus. But Jesus himself had to warn his followers against being ashamed of him. Jesus, who knowing him is the highest moral thing we can do, but we can be ashamed of knowing him. It would be unheroic, wimpy, or whatever it is. For some people, it would be wimpy to know Jesus. For other people, it would be, one is being arrogant and a colonialist or whatever for knowing Jesus. So you could be dis for all sorts of different things. An intriguing example of this would be Herod Antipas at his birthday party. You see it in Mark chapter 6. He was very angry with John the Baptist because John the Baptist told him that he should not have married his brother's wife, taken his wife away, that it was an illegitimate marriage. And got on his case for it. But his wife was even more angry than Herod with John. And the Bible sort of implies that Herod put John in prison to protect him from his wife because she was safe in prison from what she might do to him. You know the story. Herod was a Roman tetrarch, had all the leaders of Galilee and Jerusalem, the beautiful people in the area, who were there at his birthday party. His stepdaughter dances beautifully for the crowd, and he wanted to show off his wealth, power, and benevolence, and being a patron of the arts and so forth, and say, "I'll give you anything you want, even half, up to half my kingdom." And he repeated it, and he sort of gave it as almost an oath. After some coaching from her mother, most of you know the story, she comes back into the birthday party and says, "I want John the Baptist's head on a plate now. I want, don't want it tomorrow, I want it before the party's over. I want to have John the Baptist's head on a plate." It says that Herod was deeply grieved, greatly distressed. He was caught on the one hand between his moral values. He had some moral values, respect for God at some level. He knew that John the Baptist was the foremost prophet in the whole land at the time, much more widely known than Jesus ever was in Jesus' whole lifetime, and with whom he had often spoken. So the moral side of it said, "Don't touch this guy, he's a prophet of God," crying out loud. On the other hand, his own sense of heroism. He's just made a lavish promise to the assembled crowd. A powerful sense of his own need to be heroic, a powerful leader. He could not just renege on his promise without great dishonor and scorn. So he's caught between moral convictions and his need to feel heroic in this, on this public occasion. He had, I would use our term so far, we've used, he had a big impression management problem. He couldn't say, "I'm sorry, please ask for something else," without being ashamed and exposed as a fool, which he was not willing for. I've just been thinking about that. Well, what should he have said? I think what he should have said, which he wouldn't, of course, because his faith in God wasn't there. He said, "You have asked for more than I can give. Taking an innocent man's life is more than half my kingdom. I will not give you that." Anyway, that would be if he was in a different place, okay? But he wasn't in a different place. But he wasn't in a hopeless situation. Herod was so distressed because of his impression management problem. This we'd call a full identity crisis. Who was he? Was he someone who honored and followed God in his moral convictions, or was he a Roman tetrarch who saw John the Baptist as just another subject who could be taken and thrown away like trash? And both were very real in his conscious world. He was obviously extremely uncomfortable with himself for having John killed, but his desire to maintain heroic stature and self-image was a more powerful pull on him. The thing you've got to get here, his idea of being a hero was pulled stronger than his moral sensibilities. You got that? Because that's what the story totally illustrates. He feared shame much more than he feared guilt. His heroes outpulled his morality. Now this is, I think, a well-worn pattern. Actually, it's one of the things that got me interested in finding this in our students, people feeling a crossfire between their morality that came from Jesus or the Ten Commandments or something, and their models, their heroes, came from Madison Avenue or Hollywood. That's a long stretch between the two. Unless we clarify where our models are, where our heroes are, and our morals are, we can have them in very different places and not realize it. But we get in places where we either get hit by guilt or shame, no matter which choice we make, like Herod did. But they stimulate both the "who am I anyway" in the sense of the coherence question, and they're to deal with failure, which, so it's this lack of self-respect at the same time. Okay, moving on. The shrinking of our identity. This is shifting more to, the modern world is more extreme at it, but this is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on for a long time, but I think in different ways now. If we don't look to God beyond our identity, where do we look? Where do we look for identity's foundation? You can't look up, because you look up and you may see God there. You have to look within you or around you for some base for your identity. What that means is you look to some part or aspect of yourself or your surroundings or your life experience. G.K. Chesterton wrote, "When a man ceases to worship God, he does not worship nothing, he worships anything." What he's identifying is idolatry. Anything can work as a God substitute for a while. It carries the exhilaration of freedom and untethering yourself from the authority of God, but will always involve retethering yourself to something less than God, which God created. Let me say that again. It carries the exhilaration of freedom in untethering yourself from God, the authority of God, but will also involve retethering yourself to something less than God, which God made. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus warns us against having your treasure in the wrong place on earth, where it can be destroyed or stolen, but instead have it with and in God. He then made a really astute psychological observation. He said, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." That means saying that your heart will move to reside to wherever your treasure is. One of my non-Christian heroes is a man called Ernest Becker, one who I think probably wrote more than anybody in the 20th century really fascinating ways of looking at the idea of heroism. A social psychologist, ended up at Simon Fraser in Canada. Though not a Christian, he picked up on this idea, saying that we symbolically extend ourselves outward onto something we really value. And this is his quote. So, quote, "An individual's house in a posh neighborhood can be more a part of his self-image than his own arm. His lifeblood can be inseparable from it." You get what he's saying here? His posh house can be more a part of his image and identity, really, than his arm. He goes on to say that we are like amoebas, which extend their pseudopods out to enclose within themselves what they then ingest. So he says, so it is with us. When something is our real treasure or foundation, it becomes a symbolic extension of ourselves. So we are super vulnerable by what happens to our treasure, because we've gotten our heart extended out around it. Without being a Christian, Becker pointed us to what is the massive overinvestment of idolatry. It tries to get what we need from God, not just from something less than God, but from something less than we are ourselves, from a part or aspect of our own lives and experience. This is what I mean by the shrinkage of identity. Sorry, I just need more lubrication. To what do we turn? I think of the this would be an impossible time to go through all the things that we turn to be God substitutes. But in modern America, I can think quite a few things. Top of the list might be money or economic status. That's very accessible. It's right there. It's part of our lives all the time. It's obviously a source of power. Good to be connected to it. That and everything that's connected to money. Property, power, your vocation. Another would be race or ethnicity. This would be very different depending on what race you are. Most of us here are white. Our race isn't much of an issue in one way, because there's so many of us, and it's sort of like I grew up thinking that I spoke English with no accent, because everybody around me spoke it just like I did, so I have no accent. Everybody else speaks in kind of strange ways, and who come from even, I grew up 40 miles from Boston, even people who grew up in Boston speak in a different way. So mine is normal, and anybody differently is abnormal. But so it is with race. If we were all here in let's say, in Zimbabwe, and we just got released in Harare into the population, you would be much more aware of your race instantly than you are today, sitting here in this room with mainly white people. And so we've got to allow a lot of room for different racial experiences to happen to us. But especially if one is being discriminated against, race can become a very central thing, and that can easily become the central thing. Sex and gender are some of the easiest places to find your identity. You're a male or female, and that's that. although today, obviously, there's many possible self-designations in the transgender world, which are very important to the person who believes in them. Your nationality can be central to you, as can your family. Your political loyalties. We now have identity politics all around us, people who allow their identity to be framed by their political views. Your own gifts may be so important to you that they shape and control your identity. Being recognized is very important, can shape your identity, even up to being a celebrity, being a goal. You could go on and on, all sorts of things that we turn to. An important thing to say, though, is any one or several of these can be part of your identity and probably should. Your race ought to be part of your identity. Your nationality ought to be part of your identity. Your sex, your gender certainly should be part of your identity. But none of them are deep enough, wide enough, or high enough to be the central anchor for your identity. Do you see what I'm saying? None of them can be the core, can be the foundation of it, without really shrinking you. They may be partial identities, which are good and necessary, but if they're meant to bear the whole weight of being the center of your life, the axle of the wheel of your life around which everything turns, they will provide a shrunken identity and a shrunken person. I'll just take a couple of examples here. I've often heard people ask a question of say, a young boy, what are you going to be when you grow up, Johnny? And the question isn't literally the case where you're asking, what are they going to be? What job will you have? Is what the question usually means. And knowing that your job, whatever your adult status will be, financial status will be a source of real respect from other people. And Jesus was right, though. You could lose your job or your wealth, and you don't disappear and just turn into a grease spot on the floor. You're still standing there, an unemployed person. You can even lose all your money, and you do not cease to exist. You're still there. Where is your identity then? The trappings of wealth and status are not big enough to define you. They're not big enough to be the most important thing in your life. They're not big enough to anchor your identity. You need something greater than you are, not less than you are. Think of the story often referenced of some of the giants of Wall Street in 1929 threw themselves off the tops of buildings in the critical days of the first 4 or 5 days of the stock market tanking, which whole identity just is vaporized by reality. If our goal is to find our identity in our job, in our money, in our possessions, we will also be likely to treat other people as means to those ends, and spread alienation throughout our circles of influence. One of the quickest and easiest shortcuts for a foundation for identity is in your sex or gender, sex and gender, I'll say, because I'm not going to get into the big distinctions there. Sometimes our students come to Labrie and say, well, I want to know what it is to be a man, or I want to know what it is to be a woman. And I often say, that's a good question, but have you thought first about what it is to be a human person first? And usually not. There's a problem in trying to become, for example, more masculine or more feminine, although you may disagree, but just bear with me a little bit. People who do it seem to be thinking, well, to be more masculine, I will have to become more like whatever women are not. Okay? You see the logic for that? Because it's hard to get at it almost any other way. If I'm as much as I can be more like what women are not, then I will be manly. And of course, it goes the other way around. So I'm going to be more feminine. If I can be more unlike what men are like, then I'll be more feminine. It's as if we feel an obligation to prove that we are the opposite sex, starting from all the authority of stereotypes, of sex stereotypes. Dorothy Sayers quipped, why can't we be the neighboring sex? We are, after all, more like each other than anything else in the universe. But there's another problem with that strategy biblically, because the Bible is silent about giving a picture of masculinity or femininity to strive for. The closest thing I can find is that husbands and wives are given, first the main verb in that Ephesians passage is mutual understanding, mutual submission, submit yourselves one to another, and then how that's defined is different from the husband to the wife, but it's under mutual submission, and it's for husbands and wives, not for all men and all women. So I'm saying that's not an example of just maleness and femaleness. Nonetheless, stereotypes about masculinity and femininity fly around the church with huge authority, as much as they do in the secular world, and power. At the same time, God is not timid or bashful in his word about giving us a vast range of very difficult moral teaching about what sort of people we should be, none of which is sex differentiated. In other words, it's given to both men and women, both boys and girls. We are also meant to imitate Jesus, who is male, and women, not just men, but women too, are meant to imitate Jesus. And this is not because men and women are the same, as if androgyny was a Christian ideal, not at all. Men and women are gloriously different from each other, by creation and affirmed by redemption. It is that God does not want us to define what that difference is in such a way as to box in the freedom of individual men and women to be able to spread their wings as they image God. The marvelous male-female differences are rooted in creation, and they are secure enough by creation to not need to be artificially propped up by our cultural stereotypes. These stereotypes can be really destructive, like men are initiators and assertive, while women are responders and receptive. I'm sure we've all heard that. Maybe had that laid on us. The problem is that initiative and assertion, responsiveness and receptiveness are necessary human capacities, which we all need to be decent disciples of Jesus, to live out the freedom God has for us in this rich world. I asked Jock to get a book to deal with the trans issue by Preston Sprinkle called Embodied. Very, very good book. But in it, he's very pastorally involved with enormous numbers of trans people of all different stripes and so on. It just has podcasts and writing and so on. He wrote very good things on homosexuality as well. But he points out that in the trans world, an awful lot of these people who feel gender dysphoria, uncomfortable with their biologically sexually determined identity, are so because they're trying to live up to a stereotypical view of maleness or femaleness I can't be a woman. If that's what it is to be a woman, I can't be that. But if that's what it is to be a man, I can't be that. That's not the only reason, that's not the only cause of the trans movement, but that's there in a lot of the process by which people reach that sense that they want to be trans. Okay. So what I'm trying to say, and both with money and with gender, we try and build an identity there, and it backfires. Like every idol, it disappoints, but it also backfires and comes back to destroy us. It doesn't deliver what it's meant to deliver. We go through all the different things that people can put up as God substitutes. I want to conclude by making a further point, which is also a good conclusion of this talk. Two verses well known to us probably, Galatians 3:27-28. As many of you who are baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. It's no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There's no longer slave or free. There's no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. I want to think about this briefly as we come to an end here. Because we're talking about how, what I'm aiming at here is how our identity can be really grounded in Christ. And that really is in God through Christ. Paul takes three different groups, each group representing an issue which was in conflict, injustice, polarization, condescension, hatred, and so on. Race and ethnicity, extreme economic and political inequality, and sex and gender. Does that sound like today to you? I hope so. Because isn't it interesting that here he's dealing with exactly probably the three biggest issues that we have in our our discussions today. Jew and Greek condescended to each other, hated each other, going both ways, couldn't live together. And by the way, Israel was an occupied country at that time, which was not the favorite thing for the Jews. Slave and free, there you certainly have no love lost, constant systemic and personal problems of injustice and oppression going on. Male and female, throughout the whole Roman Empire, women were seen and treated as inferior to men, except in their ability to bear children. So, pairs there, but each one of those three pairs saw themselves in those terms, saw themselves in those categories, but these conflicts were between what I've been calling partial identities. Do you see what I did there? These are partial identities. Jew or Greek, slave or free, male and female. This is not less than your whole identity. But those partial identities, because they were involved in conflict, were pushing to become more full identities. Conflict always tends to ramp up and inflate our sense of what we're dealing with here. Raises the ante. Paul was not negating these groups of race or economic difference in sex, but he was saying that they were not the basic or primary identities. Now we have something, you notice the repetition of no longer. Now it's somehow different. We have something different happening. The coming of Christ into the picture means that these identities are demoted, sidelined, relativized, overshadowed by the real source of identity, which is God himself in Christ. These are partial identities are useful. They're not removed. But as one of our friends who's a social psychologist who's done a lot of work on gender, Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen, says, none of these go all the way down in terms of who we are. They don't go all the way down. The image of God goes all the way down to the bottom of who we are. We know ourselves the image of God. That can explain anything and everything that we do. It's the whole of who we are. There's much more to you and your life that can be accounted for by your race, economic status, or sex. Only the image of God accounts for the individual uniqueness, the one-of-a-kindness of each one of you, able to image, not just image of God, but image of God in only you, in a way that only you can, because you're an individual. Paul's purpose, of course, was to say that you're no longer owned by these partial identities, as if they were primary, but you are now in Christ. You are identified with letting them be in the driver's seat. You have now a new form of unity that cuts through all those, through those resentments, condescensions, injustice, and so on. And so it's as if Paul is saying, I expect you now, wouldn't before, but now, to be able to sit down beside each other in church, to eat meals together, to give to each other's needs, to serve God together in the church, and to love each other. Because of being in Christ, all these are meant to be able to be bridged because of your identity is shifted to something far larger. If he was around today, I wonder if he would ask us to be able to bridge between progressive and conservative politics. I wonder if that would be too much for us, or whether he would put that in our lap and say, take this away and do something with it. As you read Paul's letters, unity among Christians was one of his passions and a Herculean task. You read Galatians and Ephesians and Romans and all, where the church has ever since been deeply flawed, but their unity was enough to make many Romans call them the third race, because they could hold together contentious groups that nobody else could hold together. So Paul's message was, you can rise to this challenge because of who you are. You're no longer trying to inflate partial identities to hold your life together into being, because they're God's substitutes. Your true identity is in Christ. It cuts across these other divisions. It goes all the way down to the bottom of who you are. And we might build up from that foundation. The Christian must not let himself or herself have a whole identity defined by race, economic class, sex, or by any one of the other hundreds of different partial identities that are selling themselves all around us, that surround us. making outside demand of us, and also pushing us into polarizations that are unnecessary. So, to have our identity tied to who we are before God in Christ, that's good for us, and also makes us more usable as servants of God.